That was my question. Yeah. Hello again, or hello for the first time, those of you who weren't here this morning. We have people in a number of countries with us. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, at least 6 different countries. 5, 6 different countries. And yet we're all here together. As I mentioned this morning, we're here together honoring or remembering the 8th day of the 12th month, which is in Japanese westernized calendar, December 8th. In the Chinese calendar, it's sometime in January. But it's what in the Mahayana tradition, especially in Eastern Asia, which is part of that, is the day that the Buddha is recognized as having awakened that day. In Theravada tradition, they celebrate that the day of the birth and the death of the Buddha. I think it's sometime in May. In Zen, we don't celebrate that. We celebrate his awakening. So what does that mean for us? If we were in a traditional Zen setting, we would sit for 7 days and we would end on December 8th. We would sit all through the night in honor of, the story goes, the Buddha sat all night and then woke. He ended his all-night sitting by seeing the morning star. In a traditional setting, that's what would happen. We used to do that sometimes at Dana with Gena Roshi. Now they are also doing a retreat, but they started it on the 8th and they are ending it tomorrow. So a little different than when we used to do it for the whole week, the ending on the 8th. What's important is that we are sitting together and we are recognizing that. Now, I said this morning, we're celebrating the Buddha's awakening, but also our own, or our own potential to awaken. So what does that mean? There's different translations of what the Buddha supposedly said at that moment when he saw the morning star. We use that as the metaphorical moment of his awakening. And according to the different translations, they basically say the same thing. I have written on the back of one of my rakusus, Roshi wrote one version in French. It's on my purple rakusu. I recently came across a translation in English that says, I now see that all sentient beings everywhere fully possess the wisdom and virtues of the enlightened ones, plural. Often it says of the enlightened one or the Tathagata, but this is the enlightened ones, plural. But because of conceptions and attachments, they don't realize it. So everyone fully has the wisdom and virtue of those who have awakened. But because we have all these concepts and attachments, we don't realize it, that we are already awakened. And I liked this translation because of the plural enlightened ones, which opens it up to way more than just this one guy sitting on his cushion and seeing the morning, sitting under a tree and seeing the morning star. And also kind of this simple formulation that it's because of our attachments and our concepts, even our attachments to our concepts about ourself, about what is awakening, about others, about what is life, we don't realize it. Now, during this, his all-night vigil, the Buddha, the story goes, he confronted, or he triumphed, first he confronted and then triumphed over this figure we call Mara, who is really just the personification of everything that prevents us from awakening. So during this night, he confronted all of these conceptions and attachments that were preventing him from seeing things as they are, seeing himself as he truly was. And in the story, it's presented as this kind of devilish type being who tempts him with all kinds of things and questions his integrity, questions his right to even attempt to awaken. Sometimes we have these images of ourselves that said, oh, well, I'm not worthy of this. I could never be awakened. I'm not capable of it. I don't even know what it is, so I can't even begin thinking about it. So Mara tempts him with all these things, these ideas. And the Buddha finally ends up by just pointing to the ground. When in the story, when Mara says, "Who are you to even deign to think that you can awaken? I mean, really, how can you even think of that? You're just this lowly guy who has all this pretentious aspiration, but who are you? How can you prove that you're worthy of this, you know?" And the Buddha just points to the ground. And different stories give different versions of it, but he's basically saying, some of the versions say, the earth is my witness. I need nothing other than this basic ground of things as they are. Just right here. This is the throne of awakening. The ground of awakening is just right here now, things as they are. The basic nature of things is unchanging. Whether I awaken, you awaken, anyone awakens, the ground is awakened. I'm just not seeing it. And this is a really powerful image that we see often in statues of the Buddha where he's pointing to the ground. There's different interpretations of his meaning, but he's saying, I take the ground as my witness. I need nothing else to make me valid than things as they are here and now. I don't need to be someone else. I don't need to go somewhere else. I don't need to have anything else. Everything as it is perfect, we say, not in the sense of no imperfections, but good enough, valid enough, worthy of awakening, being awake. So this is what we are celebrating. Now, what does it mean to be awake? What is awakening? Also there's lots of different translations and explanations and definitions and all these marvelous, you know, poetic, elaborate thing, descriptions. But really, it's just seeing the oneness of life, seeing the oneness of all things, which is what is so elusive, because we live in this world of differences and separation, and we're so caught up in it that our concept of life is formed by that, and we miss the oneness, the non-separation. So therefore, we don't see the singularity. We see differences, but we don't see that, of course, everything is different. Every person is different. Every phenomenon is different. But we get caught up in judgments and valuations instead of just seeing it's different, it's singular, but equal. All one, all worthy. As you know, we have various ways of saying this, but when the Buddha says, I now see that all beings everywhere fully possess this the wisdom and virtue, that's what he's saying. He's saying that everybody everywhere is different and yet has this same basic nature. Everything is one. If we try to find the separations, I often use this image of the ocean and the beach, because we can't really fix where one begins and one ends, or night and day. On the, you know, in the precise calendars, every day on your phone, if you look, it will tell you, if you look at the weather or something, it tells you at what moment precisely is sunrise. But that's really not precisely when sun rises. It's always rising. It's always setting. It's absolutely actually not rising or setting. Night and day, we can't find the separation between night and day. And yet, we recognize that it's day now, and there's more light than there was at 8 in the morning, midday, in Paris anyway. And yet, if we try to see where the day began and the night ended, we can't find it. It's the same thing with our separations of everything. Where you start and I end, we can't, if we really look closely. That's what we always say when we work with koans or anything. Look closer. If we really look closely into the nature of you and me, we can't find a separation. We can see a lot of differences, but we don't see the separation. We might have borders, time zones, ages, genders, occupations, likes and dislikes. Professions, affinities. Someone likes cinema, somebody else likes television. Someone likes pizza, somebody else likes sushi. But those are just singularities. But our basic nature is the same. We are one. So how do we awaken to that? Awaken means just to experience that directly. accidents happen, right? So sometimes we see it, sometimes we don't. Sometimes we experience it, sometimes we don't. We can cultivate the ground for accidents to happen, though. seems funny that we would want an accident to happen. Well, the more we want an accident to happen, the less chance that that accident will happen. But we can cultivate the ground so that the possibility is greater. And the way that we cultivate that ground is with our practice, our sitting practice. We sit down and we let things be for a half an hour. We don't intervene. I mean, our mind is intervening a lot, probably, becoming caught up in our thoughts and our ideas and our desires and our discomfort and our projections about tomorrow or this afternoon or yesterday, whatever. But we are really sitting down and not with the intention of not doing anything for half an hour. I'm just saying before this talk. Nobody talked, nobody moved. A lot of things were going on in the street or in your household or in your stomach, in your head, but you chose not to move for those 30 minutes, which, like I like to say, is the most radical subversive thing that you could do right now today in our world, where everyone is always doing things and caught up in things and attached to things, to ideas, to themselves, to activity. Sitting down is really subversive and radical. Just sitting here right now for half an hour. And the tricky thing is that, so we take this step back and sit down for half an hour. And we can't fully appreciate the value of that unless we compare it to the rest of our life. We find the value, the true value of that when we're in the middle of our daily life, which seems like a paradox. You know, we're saying, stop, don't do anything. Just sit, let your thoughts come and go, follow your breath, all this stuff. Step away from your activities and everything. And yet, the only way to truly appreciate what we're doing is to engage in all the rest of it. Paradox, but that's Zen, right? And actually, if we really look into it and really experience it, it's not a paradox, because the two are not two. So sitting and doing nothing is really not different from getting up and doing something. But sitting and doing nothing helps us to become more attentive to the getting up and doing something. That's where the value is. We become more attentive. We're more present. We're more alive because we sat down and did nothing. You know, we have these Zen images sometimes of, so, like, we can't truly see the moon unless there are clouds, or it's a half moon, or there's a slice out of it. The placement of the sun and the moon and the earth makes it so that we can see the moon. We can't see the dark side of the moon. We can only see the light side of the moon because of the contrast. If there's no contrast, we don't see it. So in the absolute, what we call the absolute, there is no contrast. It's just fully black or fully light. We don't see the contrast. But when we have the relative world, then we see the contrasts. We see high and low, we see big and small, we see fast and slow, we see bright and dark. We see the contrasts. And we can appreciate the contrasts if we've taken the time to sit for 30 minutes and been present in the absolute, as let's say. When we sit, that's the absolute. When we get up and walk around, that's the relative. I really like this. So the Buddha is saying, you know, we all fully possess the wisdom. We all can experience the wholeness and the oneness sitting on our cushion and in everyday life. But because we're caught up in our concept of wisdom, seeing, not seeing, what we should see, what we shouldn't, what we want to see, what we don't see, all of that stuff. When we get up, we don't see it because we have this concept about it and we're attached to things how we think they are instead of how they are, how I am instead of who I really am. So, you know, I say sometimes this quote from Confucius about we have two lives. The second one begins when we see that we only have one. So we're functioning here in this world of duality. But it's actually one. And we realize that in the midst of duality, when we realize that it's not two, that the two are actually one. So that my life, just as it is the life of the Buddha. That, you know, the famous thing, chopping wood, carrying water, chopping carrots, cleaning the toilets, sweeping the floor, gardening, all of that is the ground of awakening, is the life of the Buddha, is oneness, is wholeness, is things as they are. Dogen, like Confucius, said, and Dogen's always a bit difficult to understand, so I'll try to explain this a little, my understanding of Dogen, which is, of course, partial, but Dogen says, so what we need to do is achieve enlightenment before we achieve enlightenment. So awaken before we're awakened. Or as Suzuki Roshi said, you know, if you decide that you are going to save money, engage in a practice of saving money so that you will have $1 million, as long as you're projecting and focusing on the $1 million, you won't be appreciating today, this moment. You'll be always projecting towards that $1 million. And you won't be paying attention to your effort, to everything going on around what's happening today when you're putting away $1, €1, £1. So Suzuki says, why don't you just enjoy life as you're saving for your $1 million. So that it doesn't really matter if you get your $1 million because you're enjoying today as it is. Appreciate your life. And then if you do that, well, then you wake up before you achieve awakening. Because that's what awakening is appreciating this moment as it is right now. That's why we say, you know, every step is the way. The path is the way. Sometimes we say. There is nowhere to wake up and no moment to wake up except right now. So, John Lennon, another wise statement, life is what happens when we're planning for other things. It's right now. This is it. And yet we're constantly projecting, planning, conceiving, attaching. And yet it's right now. At night we chant, you know, time swiftly passes by. It does. You know, like we say to young parents, Lara, who will be a young parent, who's already a young parent, but the baby hasn't been born yet. Will be born in 5 weeks, but you know, we say to young parents, oh, you know, appreciate it when they're small because it goes really quickly. Which is a wise thing to say, appreciate it when they're small because it goes very quickly. Sometimes we say, oh yes, those first months are horrible. You won't sleep. You don't know what you're doing. You'll be frazzled, burned out. You know, some mothers have depression, all kinds of things. After the fact, you realize that those first few months, I mean, now, you know, my son is 25. Those first few months, it's like a drop in the bucket of his life. You know, I remember how difficult it was, but kind of over really fast in a sense. Those of you who have children, I think you can remember that. But at the same time, it's just that moment. So when that baby's crying in the middle of the night and you don't know what she wants, and you don't know what to do, you're worried about bothering the neighbors, or you know, one of you has to get up and work in the morning, all that stuff, it's really real. And can we just be with it at that moment without projecting, I want it to be over. I want this kid to stop crying. I wish I was a better mother. You know, all the stuff that we have around it, instead of just being there with whatever it is. Even being there with all that stuff that we're worried about and not knowing and confused and overwhelmed. All mothers and fathers aren't like that. Some have this miraculous baby who never cries and who they know exactly what they're doing, and everyone has given them great advice and no problem. Well, that too, appreciate that without thinking, oh, maybe this baby should be crying, or maybe I should have some doubts, or you know, whatever it is, just appreciate it. Having a small child is kind of an easy one because we see the progress. It's very palpable. The rest of our life, you know, in our own lives and other stuff, we don't really see the change in the same way. Or it's changing and we don't want it to change. With the baby, we're happy that it changes. Sometimes. Sometimes we don't want the child to grow up and be a teenager, you know, but appreciate whatever it is at every moment. That's what it means to awaken. But because of our concepts and attachments, we don't realize it. People used to say that Mizumi Roshi, who was of Japanese origin and English was his second language, he would say, things as they are is perfect. So he would use the singular, he would conjugate the verb to be singularly, talking about the plural, things as they are. Things as they are is perfect. Things as they are is the true nature of things or something. And that's really interesting. It's an interesting mistake. Maybe it wasn't a mistake even. But, but we don't realize that because of our concepts and attachments. So the whole, all the big thing about Buddha's awakening and Rohatsu and celebrating it on the 8th of December, with a week of sitting and special food and lighting lights. I read somewhere that in some traditions, they kind of like with a Christmas tree, some Buddhist traditions decorate a tree with lights to symbolize all the different possibilities of awakening. All the different opportunities, all the different places, people, moments. The lights, it's infinite because it's right now. So actually there's only one moment right now. And yet, right, the right now is an infinite number of moments, but it's always right now. So that's what we celebrate. We celebrate it by sitting, we celebrate it by then getting up and moving from sitting to the heart of our life. And the way that we're practicing this online is a really good opportunity to do that. Because in a half an hour, we will get up from our cushions and turn off our screens and go into whatever the rest of the day is presenting. And that makes our practice very meaningful, much more meaningful than if we just sat here all day, in a sense. Of course, if we just sat here all day for a week, that would be meaningful too. But we would fully realize the meaning of it when we got up and interacted with each other and interacted with daily life. Whether you're a monk in a monastery or a layperson like we are in our own homes, that's the same. The monks in the monastery, they get up and they interact with each other. And they interact with having to eat, sleep, clean, wash, take care of the place they live, take care of the zendo, change the flowers, light the candles. It's the same thing. It's one, but it manifests differently. So that's what I can say for now. Any questions or comments or anything else you would like to say about this or something else? Joa?
Yeah, can you, how would you articulate seeing the oneness of life and seeing our true nature?
You mean saying those are different things, or?
Would you say they're just exactly the same, or just a different perspective, or?
Well, maybe, you know, seeing the, and even seeing is like a dangerous word because it's experiencing, but we say seeing, you know. But I think that when we experience, in my experience, experiencing whether it's who I truly am. So my true nature. Experiencing that, then we see that that is the nature of all things. So when we truly experience the oneness of me and the car, me and the cat, me and the trees, me and the sun, whatever it is, when we truly experience that non-separation, that we see the oneness of all things, and we see that that's the nature of things. See, again, I'm, you know, using that because it's not actually like with our eyes seeing, but it's a manner of speaking, experiencing it. So it is, but if we can look into the nature of things to awaken to the nature, the basic nature of things, we can look into the nature of oneself. We can look into the nature of the other. We can look into the nature of the tree. We can look into any of these different things and come to the same place. So maybe it's, what did you say? It's two expressions of the same thing, maybe? Is that what you meant? Was that the question?
Yeah, how to see, I mean, okay, maybe let me explain why I'm asking that. Because you mentioned that today, and yesterday I was reading a text from Bazui, the Zen master from the 12th century, I think, or 13th century. 12th century, I think. And there was a discussion about, so he was being asked about the paramita, the practice of the paramitas, and basically, and seeing into the true nature. And basically he says, well, you know, it's really, the bottom line is really seeing into the true nature of things. Seeing into our own true nature. That's the bottom line of the practice. So now you're talking about something else. And also from your response, I'm thinking, what does it entitles in terms of practice, the way we orient our practice? You know, it's like if we come, as you said, you know, if we come from different angles, that also entitles different type of meditation practices that we can focus on. And I've been very interested these days about how to expose that, because I'm teaching in this school, and so I'm offering each time a kind of different angle, like loving, and we have all kinds of practices like loving kindness, following the breath and all that. And so, and maybe a practice that entitles, that focuses on seeing, on focusing on who am I, or seeing the oneness of life, it kind of gives different flavor, different angles, as you said. Yeah. But it's, you know, we can approach that from different angles, from in terms of the practice, in terms of what we actually do on our cushion, right?
Yes, and I don't think I'm talking about anything different than what Bashvi was talking about. Essentially, and many of you know this, that for me, the only practice is really, who am I? That's it. That's really, who am I? If you really delve into who am I, that's the royal road. That's it right there. That's really the, I agree totally with Bassui. Seeing into who your basic nature, who you truly are, is really, that's the bottom line. And I always say that. Now we have different techniques, different practices to help us with that. The koan practice is just a different version of that. It's breaking down that question, who am I, into multiple questions, which will then help us to see into the nature of being and nature of me and different facets of that. That's why I also say koan practice is the royal road. royal, not in the sense that it's better than, you know, it's like there's a hierarchy, but for me, it's the most direct and it's the one I know best and the one that has, in my experience with myself and with others, provided real experiences of self and other. So that's it, but really it comes down to who am I? All of it comes down to who am I? All of the practices. Because when you see that, when you get to the nature of who you truly are, then everything else is clear. You see, it's like, you know, Confucius's two lives. You sit here thinking that there's you and everything else and everyone else. But when you see into the nature of you, that's when you see that there is only one. There isn't two. So all of our practices are geared to that. Now, you know, and if for me, when I can hold that, you know, it's like we said about the other night about Suzuki Roshi, the most important thing is to remember the most important thing. And so the most important thing is that, who am I? And so whatever, as a teacher, whatever I'm telling you, whatever practices I'm giving you, whatever structures I'm creating, everything, I'm always keeping an eye on that. I'm always remembering the most important thing. And everything comes from that. I adapt to the situations because that's what we have to do. Like, so Joe is in this situation with people who are not, it's nothing about Zen or Buddhism. It's completely secular. People who come sometimes and don't sometimes. It's in a university setting. So you have to adapt it to that. But if you keep your eye on the ball of this basic, what is the most important thing, then it's okay. And then you can be creative with whatever. And that's true for all of us. So we just come back to that. Keep your eye on the most important thing. Especially when you, you know, get caught up in all kinds of stuff, which we all do. You know, we get caught up in the things, like I said, you know, the passport lady not saying what I want her to say, you know. Come back to the basic. What's the point? What's the most important thing? Who am I? Not your concept of who you are. That's what the Buddhist thing is so important, you know. So we're, you know, because of our concepts and our attachments to me, and who I think I am, I don't realize who I am, really. It's like, you know, you can see on Oscar's screensaver thing, this image from Georges Méliès with the thing and shot in his eye. It's kind of like, well, that's what happens to us, you know. Whoa, we thought it was something else, and suddenly this thing gets stuck in our eye, and it's like, whoa, now I can really see. And I don't know if Oscar has that there because his Dharma name is One Eye, but might be. And I don't know if Oscar is really there listening, but his image is there. Miguel?
Good morning. I know that when you speak about oneness, you're not speaking about an idea or a concept. But for those who you're pointing to an experience, to something, to the true nature, at the same time, for those who don't dwell in that, it seems to me that it can become a concept, as you said before, of who you are or whatever. It seems that it's kind of easy to forget the empty nature of oneness and of each thing and infinity. And well, it becomes easier in some sense for me. Oneness, it's very, but at the same time, sometimes I lose I don't really know, but some aspect of unknownness, of mystery, of complete mystery. I don't know. It becomes almost accessible oneness. And then it seems that, of course, because it's an idea sometimes, and it's deeper than that. it's infinite. Well, it's this, just.
It's true that one, when we're sitting here talking, oneness is a concept, and the word, we put a word on it and totally conceptualized. It's true. And if we hang on to that, then we're stuck in the concept. And I often tell the story of when I was a student with my teacher, and for some reason it was this discussion about oneness, emptiness, which is another version of way of saying oneness. But, and I didn't know what she was talking about. And this was in a Daisan, and I didn't know what she was talking about. And I said, you know, Roshi, I don't know, or Sensei, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what emptiness or oneness, whatever, emptiness, I think we're talking. I don't know what that is. She said, yes, you do, of course you do. And I was really kind of embarrassed and felt bad that I was disappointing her, but I didn't know. And I insisted, I said, no, I don't. And she said, oh, yes, you do. Remember you told me this story, and I don't remember what the story was, but she repeated it to me about some experience you had had or something you had seen or something that happened. And I said, yeah, I know, I remember that, but that was fullness. And she said, well, same thing. So I was so caught up in my concept about what emptiness is that I couldn't recognize it. And I put a different name on it. I was calling it fullness. And she was calling it emptiness. And fortunately, she could let go of her concept and point me towards some experience I had had so that I could realize what she was talking about, right? But she's a good teacher. And I was, you know, a student caught up in my ignorance. So I think that's what we have to, like, let go of our ideas about it, what we're talking about, in order to experience it. And that's what he's saying, the Buddha, you know, our concepts and our attachments keep us from experiencing. What we're saying, though, is that when we say things as they are, it's that, and I think the reason I was talking about fullness was they're perfectly full and complete as they are, that there's nothing missing from what is, including myself. You don't need anything outside of yourself to make you complete. You are complete as you are, full, and everyone else is too. And so, you know, sometimes Bernie Glassman would say, awakening to the wholeness of life instead of oneness. The wholeness, everything is whole, complete. Nothing is missing. And so, you know, we can say chopping the carrots is complete as it is. It's perfect as it is as an experience. If we're not looking for something else, and usually when we're chopping the carrots, we're already moving ahead to chopping the garlic and then moving ahead to cooking it and moving ahead to the result we want before we've even finished peeling the carrot. So if we can just appreciate the peeling of the carrot right now, that we can have an experience of oneness, let's say, or fullness, or things as they are.
Yeah. And at the same time, I feel very much there's an attitude, and there's a fly over here in my room. She's here, and this attitude of completeness or fullness or appreciating is I can just want to listen to you or whatever and just let go away. But what was happening was, okay, just appreciate the and so it becomes a friendly relationship. Just the fly is just posing and paying attention or being in this moment with this fly. it's just this moment of what you were saying, appreciating just this.
Debbie?
Good to see everyone. Good to practice with you all. While we're on words that quickly become material for t-shirts, what is life? If I'm being one with life, I'm being one with, what am I being one with?
How are you defining life? How are you defining one? How are you defining you? How are you defining being?
Well, life, I asked you the other day what the word means. The more I look at the word, the more I don't know what it means, really. I mean, not that I don't know what it means. The more it becomes a word, a little bit what Miguel was saying about oneness, one, and, you know, it just becomes a word in advertising, have a good life, that sort of word. I feel like I'm losing touch with what it really refers to.
Yeah, I know. I knew that. I remembered that you asked. We discussed this the other day. So you know, that's why I kind of like what John Lennon says: life is what happens when we're planning for other things. He does not give, he doesn't define life for you, but that's a very direct, he's referring to some direct experience he had of life happening. Instead of being, as soon as we say being one with, then there's two things. There's me and there's life. And because with implies two that go together. Good questions, though. Lisa?
Yeah, hi. Well, it just makes me think of what happened this morning. I was not prepared at all to be Jikido and had planned all sorts of stuff for the morning in between the two sitting periods, and I wasn't sure I could stand till the end of the first one, and so all my plans just like collapsed, and for a moment I was like angry and or not angry but just like and then I could just stay with that anger or that feeling of unsatisfaction because all my plans were being reshuffled, or just be with it and okay, well, if I stay in that thing, then I'm not gonna be with just sitting. I'm gonna be with being in my thoughts, just caught up with the fact that my plans aren't going to be what they were initially. What the initial plans were. So anyway, how you just just being with what comes up at that point and or at every point and be with it fully and just move on or not move on but just anyway, you know what I mean.
And then did your anger or whatever you want, however you want to call it, was that eased by?
I was annoyed. Oh yeah, it didn't help anything to be annoyed. I just forgot about the rest and just sat. Well, it didn't happen just like that, but it happened.
Yeah, an example of when we see how much suffering we cause for ourselves, even though it was relative suffering being annoyed, but how much suffering we cause when we are attached to our concepts and our attachments of how we want things to be. And when we let go, then things become easier, or at least less suffering, let's say, less discomfort. We're about out of time here. I hope that you will enjoy your, take pleasure in your life in the next few hours and come back and sit. Enjoy the contrast in the next few hours. And I'll see you later for those who are coming back. It's at 5:30 Paris time, right? Okay. Thank you.